Here are the highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. Visit freetalklive.com for the full episode.
They had some chemistry. Cue the Barry White.
What now? What you mean they were touching each other on the arm?
Is no. Literally, Trump claimed that they had chemistry.
Oh, did he? Okay, yeah. I pulled up his tweets. I had not read through all of them yet. Did he say that in a tweet? I didn't think I saw that.
Oh, I'm not sure.
So it was. We talked about it a lot last night before it actually happened, what was kind of expected, and here on Free Talk Live, for newer listeners of the program, we followed North Korea and kind of, you know, things that we hear about happen there. You always have to keep in mind that everything that we know about North Korea, we know because people have escaped from there and they tell stories, and you don't get anything really out of there otherwise. It's just whoever manages to escape from the so-called Hermit Kingdom. And how much truth are they telling versus what is it really like? We don't know. But
well, if you get a lot of the same stories over and over again,
it becomes more believable.
It becomes much more believable.
Tends to be, yes.
Yeah. But then again, that can, you know, just be people building on other people's stories.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that I doubt the stories of the people who've spent time in the, let's say, the prison camps that they have there in North Korea, which is something that apparently did not come up in the talks
surprise.
Between Trump and Kim Jong-un yesterday. I saw it was late night. I was up late last night, of course, you know, mid-afternoon in Singapore time. One of the guys from ABC News got an interview, I guess, with Trump that went out full today, but they showed some clips from it last night.
It's hard for me with these type of agreements because that to me sounds like we agree to meet again. That doesn't sound
they
to me
that,
like
yeah.
like we agree to do anything except we agree to have another meeting, which is great.
Yeah.
Like, I'm glad you're having another meeting.
And this was the first meeting of its kind
right.
in the history of North Korea.
True. True. But, you know, far be it for either Trump or Kim to not want to be in front of the camera, to not want to, they're both media darlings in their own rights. And, it's camera time.
That's true. And if that's what it takes to get some progress,
agreed.
Then that's fine.
Agreed.
So again, the document, there is a photo that reveals the leaders, so-called, agreed on these 4 points. Number one, the United States and the DPRK commit to establish new U.S.-DPRK relations in accordance with the desire of the peoples of the two countries for peace and prosperity. Number two, the United States and DPRK will join their efforts to build a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. Three, reaffirming the April 27, 2018 Panmunjom Declaration, the DPRK commits to work toward the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Hmm. And number four, the United States and DPRK commit to recovering POW/MIA remains, including the immediate repatriation of those already identified. Is Donald Trump more of a peace president than the last few just because of this one move?
No.
No. Okay.
Donald Trump has a style of foreign policy interaction that for whatever reason resonated or the opposite of resonated maybe with the North Koreans to the point that it has brought them to the table. Plus, there was probably something that happened to the North Korean nuclear program in some way or another that also coincidentally brought them to the table.
So you're saying when Donald Trump was sort of rattling the saber back
yeah.
at them, that's not a peace president
it
move,
scared
right?
Them. Yeah. Right.
Well,
it scared them.
Yeah, and I'm going to agree because there was no war in North Korea. There was no hot war, there was no drone bombings. It's not like he ceased hostilities and
true.
Ended something. I mean, there's been threats back and forth since the end of the no, it didn't even end. Since
that's right,
the armistice, since the armistice of the Korean War,
it's supposed to be ending now that the South Korean and the North Korean presidents have come together. And
see, I guess my worry is with Donald Trump being the wanting to be the business president, that what we're really going to wind up with here is we're going to wind up with the exact same regime, being exactly just as brutal to its population,
right.
still enslaving them.
Just stick with the federal government and just nullify all the stuff you don't like that they do.
Well, you can run if you'd like. Yeah. Your filing period closes on Friday, Mark.
Thanks so much.
I think it'd be fun to have you file as the Republican and I could file as the Libertarian.
That's
as
awesome.
I've done.
Yeah,
and then
that'd be great.
Take each other on in the general election and lose to the Democrat ultimately because that seat's gone to a Democrat for the last 10 years. Yeah. Although not forever. When we first moved here, it was a Republican that held that seat.
So it's not, they changed the district up.
Impossible.
Now I have a question for you, because what I've heard from everybody, and of course, I'm new. I've been here for 2 months, although I have, followed over the years, seems that the conventional wisdom is that libertarians can't win in this state. How do you feel about that whole thing, that you have to run as a Republican?
It's clearly false. Okay. Libertarians actually did win in the 1990s when they had a party that was strong enough to actually have ballot access, which it now has reached again. So the Libertarians in 2016 hit over 4% for their gubernatorial candidate, who really wasn't very Libertarian at all. I think he benefited from the fact that the national level frustration was so palpable. People were so angry about Trump versus Hillary that a bunch more people voted Libertarian. It wasn't because Gary Johnson was a great candidate. Trump tweeted about it, of course, today, saying, quote, "Back home from Singapore, after a truly amazing visit, great progress was made on the denuclearization of North Korea. Hostages are back home. We'll be getting the remains of our heroes back to their families. No missile shot, no research happening, sites closing. Got along great with Kim Jong-un, who wants to see wonderful things for his country. As I said earlier today, anyone can make war, but only the most courageous can make peace. Hashtag Singapore Summit."
That was one tweet?
Two of them.
Oh, I was about to say, that's the world's longest. Did he get the presidential length tweet? Like, what's going on here?
You know they've lengthened tweets, right?
They doubled the tweet length.
Yeah. That was a lot longer than the double tweet length.
I just wanted to make sure that everyone knew.
Yeah, so yes.
Arguably, they doubled the tweet length just so Donald Trump could tweet more ridiculous things.
You might be right.
Yeah. So a little bit more here from the full text. So after the 4 points, it says, and it's very short, it says, "Having acknowledged that the U.S. DPRK summit, the first in history, was an epochal event of," that's a word you don't hear very often, "of great significance."
Hold on, is it a real word?
Epochal, yes. Like, yes, epic. Epochal.
Okay, got those kavifi.
Kavifi. "Of great significance in overcoming decades of tensions and hostilities between the two countries, and for the opening up of a new future, President Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un commit to implement the stipulations of this joint statement fully and expeditiously."
I saw a friend on Facebook say something to the effect of, "Donald Trump has just told every tin-pot dictator all he has to do reach the world stage or get free stuff or whatever it was that he claimed, was to have nuclear weapons." Not that that's an easy thing to do.
Well, I would have asked that guy, can you name another tin-pot dictator, please?
Great point. Comey. Comey 2012.
I guess I don't know a lot of tin-pot dictators, so I don't know, but, you know.
So basically, he told no one anything.
Yeah, exactly. That's not to say there aren't other horrible men ruling over other lands of the world.
Sure.
But, you know, Kim Jong-un deserves credit for being the one who's rattled the saber the loudest and has created a name for himself.
Sure.
He really has.
Sure.
And so, here we are. And kudos to Donald Trump for pulling this one off. He did it, whereas no one else in the past could ever do or ever even tried to do anything like this. He's converted one of the so-called axis of evil, because remember, North Korea was labeled that by George W. Bush.
I don't know that he has converted. He is in the process of converting.
Yeah. So
we'll see how the things go.
Newly released satellite imagery, and this was published at the end of May, by the way, shows that North Korea's prison camp system, where detainees are subjected to forced labor, torture, starvation, rape, and death, may be expanding. Up to 120,000 men, women, and children are imprisoned in the gulags, known as Kwanliso in Korean, according to the United Nations. Pyongyang officially denies the camps even exist, but multiple human rights groups have documented their ongoing operation via survivor testimony as well as satellite imagery.
Yeah, it's not like, every country has prisons, and you would presume a poor country would have really crappy prisons.
Sure. Of course, these camps are ostensibly prisons in which you will be locked up if your son commits a crime. So if you and your family were living in North Korea and Jack went out and stole something, they might just go ahead and lock up every, like three generations, basically. They'll lock his grandmother up, lock you up, lock your wife up. Basically, they punish the entire family for what one person has done, which is insane.
That'll keep in line.
That's intense.
Yeah, and there's a name for it, and I forget what it's like, intergenerational punishment or something like that. There's some kind of name for that.
So the population of North Korea, I just looked at it,
25 million?
25 million. Yeah. You said 120?
120,000 people.
Thousand.
Yeah. So allegedly.
So that's percentage-wise, because I believe there's something like a million people incarcerated in the United States.
Oh, I bet you the U.S. has a much larger percentage.
No, it's about the same. The concessions that Kim is going to want are going to be economic. He's
sure.
going to want to open up his country and to bring in businesses, and ostensibly it's going to be manufacturing. And this really bothers me. If this is, I honestly could see Trump never putting this on the table, mm-hmm. and that these things basically turn into slave labor camps that are
for corporations.
Yeah. I mean, I so see it, and that bothers me.
Yeah, I didn't think of this, but I think you could be right. If this isn't done properly, like any move towards more freedom,
of course.
If the moves towards freedom are only moves for the economically advantaged towards freedom, then you don't have freedom, right? Like,
that's right.
You know, if you just take one
class,
well,
we don't have freedom,
right?
Right. Certainly, the wealthy have more freedom than the poor in places like the United States and other places in the world generally.
North Korea. I mean, the freedom in. I don't even know that it's a matter of wealth, though, right? It's just like, if you have any money at all in North Korea, that means that you're part of the power elite, because everybody else has nothing.
Nothing.
You're basically just begging that money off of Kim Jong-un by showing some level of loyalty or whatever,
right.
And then he doles out levels of favor. You know, you kind of, you know, reach up in rank or whatever,
yeah.
and you get more better things.
You went to prison for 2 years because you drove on a suspended license in New Hampshire.
Basically. Yeah. And nothing else, really. I mean,
right.
it was,
wow.
you know, it wasn't like I was killing people on the roads,
right.
or you know, no drunk driving.
You disobeyed
no,
the state. Drunk drivers, I was in jail for civil disobedience, and the drunk drivers were in there for 21 days.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, and then there's all of the commerce that goes on that's made illegal by prohibition. I mean,
right.
all of that stuff to me is in political imprisonment.
Right.
It is people mm-hmm. who have decided a certain thing about a substance or about an activity that is not harmful that they are choosing to throw people in cages for.
Yeah.
And
When you were in prison, you know, for 2 years in New Hampshire, again, state prison. Did you get any kind of feel for how many of the other guys that were in there were there for nonviolent, victimless offenses like drug dealing, that kind of thing?
That was one of the major questions that I asked mm-hmm. amongst folk there. And I asked that amongst people that I, you know, became friendly with within the place. And their belief is that there is more than 50%.
If you're going to be incarcerated, it's better to not have to be picking corn pellets out of human feces in order to sustain your diet, as some
True.
People have reported that they had to do in North Korean prison labor camps. So certainly there's one place that would be preferable to the other, but that still doesn't mean that, you know, people's lives aren't ruined by the U.S. government's
Absolutely.
Prison system, that they aren't institutionalized by it, and to where they, when they get out, they don't know what to do with their lives. They're despondent, as, you know, as he was just pointing, our caller was just pointing out there after he got out. You know, so these things have very intense effects on people's lives, mm-hmm. and ultimately, you're talking about a significant number of people within the United States who are there for nonviolent crimes. And the same thing's true in North Korea, where there's a
Sure.
lot of people there for smuggling a flash drive, right? Or attempting to simply escape from the country.
Well, so, I'm sure of just speaking out and speaking their mind. I'm sure, you know,
yeah.
probably something completely innocuous.
Or they didn't bow in front of the statue Kim Il-sung.
Exactly.
You know, you mentioned people getting out of prison being institutionalized, and certainly these things happen. But institutionalization can happen essentially to anybody in any circumstance where they just become too, attached to, being cared for.
Okay.
Right? There's the routine and there's being cared for. Prison cares for you.
A little bit more here from the CNN piece about the prison camps, where they've, you know, they've got comments from Amnesty International and another human rights, watchdog group. According to this story, the UN report in 2014 estimated that hundreds of thousands of political prisoners have died. So again, there's 120,000 estimated to be there now.
Oh boy.
What about all the ones that were, like, tortured to death over the last 60 years, right? So... Yeah.
It's not uncommon. I mean, this is a way to deal with your least desired political dissidents is basically put them to work in the mines or wherever, and they just don't come out.
And they expire sometime. According to the story here, again, this has been over the last 50 years. They say hundreds of thousands have died in these gulags. Quote, the inmate population has been gradually eliminated through deliberate starvation, forced labor, executions, torture, rape, and the denial of reproductive rights, said the report, drawing a parallel between the camps and those of Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Former bodyguard of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il told CNN in 2014 of beatings and forced starvation in the camp that he was imprisoned in after he unsuccessfully tried to flee to South Korea.
Mm.
Man.
So here's one story.
Kim Jong-il didn't ever leave North Korea, so the bodyguard then would never leave North Korea.
Kim Jong-il did leave, as I understand it, briefly.
Didn't he leave on a train? Wasn't
there
a train?
To go to China.
Trains to China, yeah.
He did take some trips to China, but that's about it. Recalling the executions, Danby, who's now 26, says, quote, four men and two women were tied to wooden poles and pleading for mercy. Executioners wrapped their bodies in plastic sheets and put stones into their mouths. She says, I heard the clapping sound of shots, saw their agonized struggle, then stillness amongst the blood.
Why wrap them in plastic and put stones in their mouths?
So that it was, I guess, not as hard to clean it up?
Yeah, but the plastic part. Stones, maybe to keep them quiet?
I was so deeply traumatized by what I saw, I couldn't eat for days. Brave Danby is speaking out after fleeing North Korea in her late teens. Her brother, a police officer, hasn't been seen for years after being thrown into political prison. Well, Danby grew up in an era when Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, ruled. North Korea remains as secretive as ever. Danby says, quote, the world knows hardly anything of North Korea beyond propaganda films. We will only learn from real stories from people who lived there. She says, until my last breath, I will carry on working to tell the inside story of North Korea in the name of my lost brother. She grew up in Haesan in Ryanggang province. Her father managed a state museum, and her family were given good rations during the 1990s famine, which left more than 2 million North Koreans dead.
Wow.
She has happy... All the while, of course, South Korea is eating very well.
Right.
She has happy childhood memories of playing on the mountains and eating wild strawberries, but that joy and those freedoms were short-lived.
North Korea, I'm kind of excited. I've been wanting to go there for years. You know, every time we go to China, it's just a short hop over from China to North Korea.
But easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, from North Korea, it's not hard to do.
From China, you mean?
I mean, from China, it's not really hard to do. It can be done. My wife would never wanted to go, so we never really made a serious effort. But now it's looking like perhaps it'll get a little bit easier, and perhaps we'll actually make a trip there this time. But
could be.
I'm, you know, cause
if
I,
so, I
I'm
want you to so, call from North Korea and tell us all about it.
I will certainly
because I don't have the balls to go there, man. I'd be afraid I wouldn't make it out.
Well, I had that fear when I first went to China 25 years ago. You know, I figured that's going over there, communist country and all that. And I thought, oh my gosh, what happens if they throw me in a gulag and I never get out? And I found out it wasn't at all like that. But I have a feeling that North Korea, I've watched a lot of videos on YouTube about North Korea, people that have been there. And as far as the tourism and stuff, they do have tour groups that go through there, and they do kind
of,
you know, they treat them a little bit better. They, they try to,
they take them to all the North Korean government approved locations for tourists to see.
It's true. I mean, you're not going to see all of the dirty stuff. It's the brainwashing that fascinates me. And I take that back. I take that lesson in brainwashing and I apply it here at home, because the brainwashing here is getting to the point where, because I did that in China, you know, when I went to China, I saw the conditioning in China, and I brought back to home the lessons that I learned in China. And in reality, I found that in China, in some ways, there was less brainwashing than here. It depended on, you know, what areas of society we were talking about, because in some areas in China, I found that there was more liberty. And in some areas in the U.S., I found we had less liberty.
I would think if you lived in a sort of a dictatorship, you might very well understand it. But whereas if you're told your whole life you're free, and you know the you know, land of the free, home of the brave, and all those things, then you might not see the air. See, when your freedoms are slipping away, when you're moving down on the economic freedom charts around the world, you might not see the military-industrial complex collusion with the executive branch and the legislative branch, and how it manages to, you know, get. If people, young men and women to go over to war zones and fight and die for something they call freedom, which is in fact the opposite. Communism in the Soviet Union wasn't nearly so socially conservative as must be in North Korea. The really? Idea that seeing boys and girls talking or whatever.
So she says that she had begun doing some smuggling DVDs across, or like taking them from smugglers mm-hmm. or whatever. In North Korea, she says girls were expected to be subservient. This story, by the way, from The Mirror over in the UK. She says, further, wearing anything other than conservative North Korean clothing meant we'd be stopped by the youth brigade and interrogated.
Is the youth brigade full of young people, or is it...
Yeah, these are like your Hitler Youth.
A police, okay, police force yeah. for the
that's,
youth.
That's typical of any authoritarian state. You got to have that kind of...
Yeah.
That paramilitary...
Bring them in young.
Yeah,
have the Cub Scouts kind of thing.
Yeah.
Why are you wearing the clothes of the Imperial... And then there's a censored word here that begins with a B. Bastards, maybe?
Maybe.
I'm guessing bastards because it ends in an S. What is Kim Il-sung's birth date?
Oh, yeah, that's right. We have to know that.
Answering incorrectly Whoa. Saw us hit on the head, thighs, or buttocks, and then reported to parents, school, or police. She
Whoa.
Said... The DVDs showed me women elsewhere had freedom to change their looks and clothes and express their personalities. It was the biggest revelation of my life.
Could you imagine that is a revelation?
I know.
A revelation that you can change your clothes?
Quote, torture in a police station is hell, but in a political detention center, you're treated as if you're not human. We were driven to a block in a mountain range with hoods over our heads.
Oh my God.
I was made to watch while they hit my brother with a cane that sliced into his skin. When they tied his arms up and beat him, I cried at every punch and kick to his head. For me, they got a thick rod, jammed it between my knees, and made me sit like that for 8 hours.
Oh my God.
When I didn't confess, they hit me with a band until my skin turned black. She says my brother could hear me crying at night in an adjoining cell, so he gently sang to me through the pipes to calm me. He said he would take all the blame. I confessed to smuggling, but not the more serious crime. 6 weeks later... which seems relatively short compared to some sentences in North Korea. She was freed, but her brother has not been seen since. He is among the estimated 100,000 people, or as we heard earlier, 120,000, in these camps. So now,
oh my God.
Yeah, now a risk to her family, Danby had to escape. She fled on August 13th of 2011, at the time age 19, crossed into China, then headed 3,000 miles to Southeast Asia to gain access to South Korea as a refugee. She's now married and working in a hotel, and she says, quote, starting a new life has been tough. I speak to relatives each week by phone. Fury over my brother's jailing still burns.
This is the 15 signs that the middle class in the United States is being systemically destroyed, destroyed. And I'm not reading this because I necessarily believe that this statement is true, but more because I think that the 15 points are all very interesting.
It's something to talk about for sure.
Now, did they define what they mean by middle class? Because I think that's a very subjective term, isn't it?
Well, I think you generally what people do is they take income and then they break it out into quintiles.
Okay.
Meaning 20%, bottom 20%, top 20%, and then middle 60. So middle class is either the middle 20%, so the third quintile.
Got it.
Or it's the middle three quintiles, depending
60%.
On... Yeah, so it would be lower middle class, and upper middle class.
Gotcha.
So you have the lowest class, which we call working class, which probably isn't true at all. We have the highest class.
Fair enough.
Which is, you know, upper class or whatever, which probably isn't making that much money and mostly just lives in metros where you have to make a lot of money to have an upper middle class.
San Francisco, LA, New York.
Those kind of things. So if your family's really struggling right now, you're far from alone. I've been publishing the Economic Collapse blog for more than 8 years, and all throughout that time, I've seen the middle class in America get smaller and smaller and smaller. I remember paying off my house in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, that was completely done by shoestrings and, you know, eating at home. And
you came from prison.
Yeah. Saving money and all those things.
Right.
I wouldn't say completely, but, you know, it was just.
You did get a loan from your mom.
Yeah. My mom helped buy the house, but then I paid her back on it.
So that would make you middle class. In that case, right?
Well,
see, I've always thought that's what the middle class was. I've always thought that the middle class was like that you could buy a house, pay it off before you had fully retired, then be able to retire and sort of like it. Maybe back in the day, it was like only one person had to work. You know, it's like you're not wealthy. Maybe you don't pass on a huge inheritance or something like that, but at least you end up owning your house. Maybe
I paid mine
off
in 3 years.
Well, that's impressive.
Now, admittedly, it was an 800 square foot house, but it was big enough for everything we needed.
Right.
So, you know, that was I managed to do that in the economic downturn by we just did a bunch of belt tightening. Mm-hmm. No cable TV. Mm-hmm. Just basically, what are these line items here? Can we X off? 78 million Americans are participating in the gig economy because full-time jobs just don't pay enough to make ends meet these days. But didn't we just call that working overtime back in the day?
Having a second job.
Yep. Moonlighting.
Remember? Moonlighting, sure. Yeah.
And the gig economy is better than a second job, right? Because if you have a first job, having a second job was always a challenge to try to get them all to interact, right? Because your first job schedule is the most important. And then you're trying to get your second job to give you a schedule that'll work around the first job. And sometimes that doesn't always work out depending on what hours they have available. But with a gig economy, you set your own hours. Mm-hmm. So TSA George is actually in the studio hanging out with us here tonight, and he's now Uber George. He's been doing Ubering for a few years, and you get to log into these apps when you want to.
Right.
So that means that if you're in a city, which is usually where you want to be if you want to do this kind of gig work, if you're in a city and you feel like working after you get off your other job for however many hours you want to, you can. So you are basically a contract worker rather than an employee who has to figure out their schedule in advance. That's a big bonus, actually. Mm-hmm. That's an improvement on the situation for somebody that felt as though they had to have a second job previously. Now they don't have to have a job.
Young people tend to be the worst at managing money.
Sure.
If they were good at it, they would all take their money for the first 5 years they worked, invest it in a 401k, and then have their retirement handled at $1 million or something. Mm-hmm. But they don't. There's some formula out there that I was shown when I was younger and didn't invest. So anyway, the United States today, 66% of all jobs pay less than $20 an hour.
Hold on. Is this another one?
This is number four.
Okay.
In the United States today, 66% of all jobs pay less than $20 an hour. I don't know what that's relative to, or
I mean,
you know,
is that inflation adjusted as compared to? Like,
he's not even comparing it, right? He's not even giving us another point,
right? Well, but I agree that these points are not good evidence that the middle class is being
because
given.
In 1863 all jobs were less than $20 an hour. Like, what do you want? Right.
I saw an interesting one. It was like in the 1830s, 85% of Americans were below the poverty line, which
sure,
yeah, I mean, you know.
But they were farming.
But that was
subsistence
awful.
Farming.
Yeah, and a bad season meant people got thin.
Right. Absolutely.
102 million working age Americans do not have a job right now. And that number is higher than it has been ever at any point during the last recession. And that would be, you know, basically higher than I think it's ever been ever. More or less. Mm-hmm. I mean, so.
Well, there's more people living here.
Right. There's more people living in America.
Good point,
But I guess about a third of. I don't know what the. I can't figure this out how many working age Americans there are. There's more than 300 million Americans, but working age is considered something like 16 to 64. People are working a lot longer, but they wouldn't be counted as working age whether or not. And people are going to work a lot later. Kids are, in many cases, aren't starting jobs until they're 24.
Oh, God.
And as far as I'm concerned, you're runt.
Helicopter parents' kids, right, where their mommy and daddy are always hovering over them, trying to protect them from any kind of experience in life, and then sending them off to college and discouraging them from working while they're in college. So, you know, then they finally get released out of college, and they don't have a clue as to how to do the most basic job functions. They've never had one, so they don't know how to show up on time.
That's right.
They don't know how to smile when they're dealing with their customers. They have no experience whatsoever.
You just heard highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. You can download full episodes, subscribe to our podcast, listen live, and more, all for free at freetalklive.com.